Sir. A summary report of the Yelcho expedition to the Antarctic, 1909-1910, by Ursula K. Le Guin. In 2014, Ursula K. Le Guin received the National Book Foundation Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. She shares that honor with such writers as Eudora Welty, Toni Morrison, Judy Blume, Stephen King, Ray Bradbury, Arthur Miller, and Gwendolyn Brooks. That isn't the first such major literary award Ursula has won. The Library of Congress honored her with its Living Legend designation. She has won the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction, the Margaret A. Edwards Award for her contributions to young adult literature, and a slew of Lifetime Achievement Awards. She's been shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize. She's won a Newbery Award and a National Book Award. In the science fiction and fantasy genre, she has received SFWA's Grand Master Award and the Gandalf Award. She was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Over her long career, she has won 5 Nebula Awards and 6 Hugos. I did not look to see how many times she's been nominated. If I were to continue listing just her awards and honors, I would use up the remaining word count for this introduction, and I wouldn't even make it to a discussion of the fiction. When she won the Margaret A. Edwards Award, the award committee chair noted in the press release accompanying the announcement, "A fantasy writer and social activist since her youth, Ursula K. Le Guin has inspired 4 generations of young adults to read beautifully constructed language, visit fantasy worlds that inform them about their own lives, and think about their ideas that are neither easy nor inconsequential." That award focused on Le Guin's fantasy series, Earthsea. But she's equally important to science fiction. Her novel, The Left Hand of Darkness, continually makes lists of the best science fiction novels of all time. It certainly inspired and challenged me, just as Ursula's short stories and essays have. Initially, I planned to use one of Ursula's early short stories, a personal favorite of mine called Semele's Necklace, which fits into the universe of the technological Hainish cycle. The story proved longer than I remembered. Then I read Sir for the first time and realized it's alternate history, a subgenre I didn't have yet in this anthology. Sir is a sly tale of 9 women who arrive at the South Pole over a year before Roald Amundsen's all-male team reached the pole on 14 December 1911. Sir has a richness and a depth that marks the best Le Guin stories. It also, in its own way, speaks to the theme of this entire anthology. Sir, the map in the attic. Although I have no intention of publishing this report, I think it would be nice if a grandchild of mine or somebody's grandchild happened to find it someday. So I shall keep it in the leather trunk in the attic, along with Rosita's christening dress and Juanito's silver rattle, and my wedding shoes, and finiscos. The first requisite for mounting an expedition, money, is normally the hardest to come by. I grieve that even in a report destined for a trunk in the attic of a house in a very quiet suburb of Lima, I dare not write the name of the generous benefactor, the great soul without whose unstinting liberality the Yelcho expedition would never have been more than the idlest excursion into daydream. That our equipment was the best and most modern, that our provisions were plentiful and fine, that a ship of the Chilean government, with her brave officers and gallant crew, was twice sent halfway round the world for our convenience. All this is due to that benefactor whose name, alas, I must not say, but whose happiest debtor I shall be till death. When I was little more than a child, my imagination was caught by a newspaper account of the voyage of the Belgica, which, sailing south from Tierra del Fuego, became beset by ice in the Bellingshausen Sea and drifted a whole year with the flow, the men aboard her suffering a great deal from want of food and from the terror of the unending winter darkness. I read and reread that account and later followed with excitement the reports of the rescue of Dr. Nordenskjold from the South Shetland Isles by the dashing Captain Irisar of the Uruguay and the adventures of the Scotia in the Weddell Sea. But all these exploits were to me but forerunners of the British National Antarctic Expedition of 1902 to 1904 in the Discovery, and the wonderful account of that expedition by Captain Scott. This book, which I ordered from London and reread 1,000 times, filled me with longing to see with my own eyes that strange continent, last Thule of the South, which lies on our maps and globes like a white cloud, a void, fringed here and there with scraps of coastline, dubious capes, supposititious islands, headlands that may or may not be there. Antarctica. And the desire was as pure as the polar snows, to go to sea, no more, no less. I deeply respect the scientific accomplishments of Captain Scott's expedition, and have read with passionate interest the findings of physicists, meteorologists, biologists, etc. But having had no training in any science nor any opportunity for such training, my ignorance obliged me to forego any thought of adding to the body of scientific knowledge concerning Antarctica. And the same is true for all the members of my expedition. It seems a pity, but there was nothing we could do about it. Our goal was limited to observation and exploration. We hoped to go a little farther, perhaps, and see a little more, if not simply to go and to see. A simple ambition, I think, and essentially a modest one. Yet it would have remained less than an ambition, no more than a longing, but for the support and encouragement of my dear cousin and friend, Juana Blank. I use no surnames, lest this report fall into strangers' hands at last, and embarrassment or unpleasant notoriety thus be brought upon unsuspecting husbands, sons, etc. I had let Juana my copy of The Voyage of the Discovery, and it was she who, as we strolled beneath our parasols across the Plaza de Armas, after Mass one Sunday in 1908, said, "Well, if Captain Scott can do it, why can't we?" It was Juana who proposed that we write Carlotta Blank in Valparaiso. Through Carlotta, we met our benefactor and so obtained our money, our ship, and even the plausible pretext of going on retreat in a Bolivian convent, which some of us were forced to employ, while the rest of us said we were going to Paris for the winter season. And it was my Juana who, in the darkest moments, remained resolute, unshaken in her determination to achieve our goal. And there were dark moments, especially in the early months of 1909, times when I did not see how the expedition would ever become more than a quarter ton of pemmican gone to waste, and a lifelong regret. It was so very hard to gather our expeditionary force together. So few of those we asked even knew what we were talking about. So many thought we were mad or wicked or both. And of those few who shared our folly, still fewer were able, when it came to the point, to leave their daily duties and commit themselves to a voyage of at least 6 months, attended with not inconsiderable uncertainty and danger. An ailing parent, an anxious husband beset by business cares, a child at home with only ignorant or incompetent servants to look after it. These are not responsibilities lightly to be set aside, and those who wished to evade such claims were not the companions we wanted in hard work, risk, and privation. But since success crowned our efforts, why dwell on the setbacks and delays, or the wretched contrivances and downright lies that we all had to employ? I look back with regret only to those friends who wished to come with us but could not, by any contrivance, get free, those we had to leave behind to a life without danger, without uncertainty, without hope. On the 17th of August, 1909, in Punta Arenas, Chile, all the members of the expedition met for the first time. Juana and I, the two Peruvians from Argentina, Zoe, Berta, and Teresa, and our Chileans, Carlota and her friends Eva, Pepita, and Dolores. At the last moment, I had received word that Maria's husband in Quito was ill, and she must stay to nurse him, so we were 9, not 10. Indeed, we had resigned ourselves to being but 8, when just as night fell, the indomitable Zoe arrived in a tiny pirogue manned by Indians, her yacht having sprung a leak just as it entered the Strait of Magellan. That night, before we sailed, we began to get to know one another, and we agreed, as we enjoyed our abominable supper in the abominable seaport inn of Punta Arenas, that if a situation arose of such urgent danger, that one voice must be obeyed without present question. The unenviable honor of speaking with that voice should fall first upon myself. If I were incapacitated, upon Carlota, if she, then upon Berta. We three were then toasted as Supreme Inca, La Araucana, and the third mate, among a lot of laughter and cheering. As it came out, to my very great pleasure and relief, my qualities as a leader were never tested. The 9 of us worked things out amongst us from beginning to end without any orders being given by anybody, and only 2 or 3 times with recourse to a vote by voice or show of hands. To be sure, we argued a good deal, but then we had time to argue. And one way or another, the arguments always ended up in a decision upon which action could be taken. Usually, at least one person grumbled about the decision, sometimes bitterly. But what is life without grumbling and the occasional opportunity to say, "I told you so"? How could one bear housework or looking after babies, let alone the rigors of sledge hauling in Antarctica, without grumbling? Officers, as we came to understand aboard the Yelcho, are forbidden to grumble. But we 9 were, and are by birth and upbringing, unequivocally and irrevocably all crew. Though our shortest course to the southern continent, and that originally urged upon us by the captain of our good ship, was to the South Shetlands and the Bellingshausen Sea, or else by the South Orkneys into the Weddell Sea, we planned to sail west to the Ross Sea, which Captain Scott had explored and described, and from which the brave Ernest Shackleton had returned only the previous autumn. More was known about this region than any other portion of the coast of Antarctica, and though that more was not much, yet it served as some insurance of the safety of the ship, which we felt we had no right to imperil. Captain Pardo had fully agreed with us after studying the charts and our planned itinerary, and so it was westward that we took our course out of the strait next morning. Our journey half round the globe was attended by fortune. The little Yelcho steamed cheerily along through gale and gleam, climbing up and down those seas of the Southern Ocean that run unbroken round the world. Juana, who had fought bulls and the far more dangerous cows on her family's estancia, called the ship La Vaca Valiente, because she always returned to the charge. Once we got over being seasick, we all enjoyed the sea voyage, though oppressed at times by the kindly but officious protectiveness of the captain and his officers, who felt that we were only safe when huddled up in the 3 tiny cabins which they had chivalrously vacated for our use. We saw our first iceberg much farther south than we had looked for it, and saluted it with Veuve Clicquot at dinner. The next day we entered the ice pack, the belt of floes and bergs broken loose from the land ice and winter-frozen seas of Antarctica, which drifts northward in the spring. Fortune still smiled on us. Our little steamer, incapable with her unreinforced metal hull of forcing a way into the ice, picked her way from lane to lane without hesitation. And on the third day we were through the pack, in which ships have sometimes struggled for weeks and been obliged to turn back at last. Ahead of us now lay the dark gray waters of the Ross Sea, and beyond that, on the horizon, the remote glimmer, the cloud-reflected whiteness of the great ice barrier. Entering the Ross Sea a little east of longitude west 160 degrees, we came in sight of the barrier at the place where Captain Scott's party, finding a bite in the vast wall of ice, had gone ashore and sent up their hydrogen gas balloon for reconnaissance and photography. The towering face of the barrier, its sheer cliffs and azure and violet water-worn caves, all were as described. But the location had changed. Instead of a narrow bight, there was a considerable bay, full of the beautiful and terrific orca whales playing and spouting in the sunshine of that brilliant southern spring. Evidently masses of ice, many acres in extent, had broken away from the barrier, which, at least for most of its vast extent, does not rest on land but floats on water, since the Discovery's passage in 1902. This put our plan to set up camp on the barrier itself in a new light, and while we were discussing alternatives, we asked Captain Pardo to take the ship west, along the barrier face towards Ross Island and McMurdo Sound. As the sea was clear of ice and quite calm, he was happy to do so, and when we sighted the smoke plume of Mount Erebus, to share in our celebration another half case of Veuve Clicquot. The Yelcho anchored in a rival bay, and we went ashore in the ship's boat. I cannot describe my emotions when I set foot on the earth. On that earth, the barren, cold gravel at the foot of the long volcanic slope. I felt elation, impatience, gratitude, awe, familiarity. I felt that I was home at last. Eight Adélie penguins immediately came to greet us with many exclamations of interest, not unmixed with disapproval. Where on earth have you been? What took you so long? The hut is around this way. Please come this way. Mind the rocks. They insisted on our going to visit Hut Point, where the large structure built by Captain Scott's party stood, looking just as in the photographs and drawings that illustrate his book. The area about it, however, was disgusting. A kind of graveyard of seal skins, seal bones, penguin bones, and rubbish, presided over by the mad, screaming skua gulls. Our escorts waddled past the slaughterhouse in all tranquility, and one showed me personally to the door, though it would not go in. The interior of the hut was less offensive, but very dreary. Boxes of supplies had been stacked up into a kind of room within the room. It did not look as I had imagined it when the Discovery part put on their melodramas and minstrel shows in the long winter night. Much later we learned that Sir Ernest had rearranged it a good deal when he was there just a year before us. It was dirty, and had about it a mean disorder. A pound tin of tea was standing open. Empty meat tins lay about. Biscuits were spilled on the floor. A lot of dog turds were underfoot, frozen, of course, but not a great deal improved by that. No doubt the last occupants had had to leave in a hurry, perhaps even in a blizzard. All the same, they could have closed the tea tin. But housekeeping, the art of the infinite, is no game for amateurs. Teresa proposed that we use the hut as our camp. Zoe counter-proposed that we set fire to it. We finally shut the door and left it as we had found it. The penguins appeared to approve and cheered us all the way to the boat. McMurdo Sound was free of ice, and Captain Pardo now proposed to take us off Ross Island and across to Victoria Land, where we might camp at the foot of the Western Mountains, on dry and solid earth. But those mountains, with their storm-darkened peaks and hanging cirques and glaciers, looked as awful as Captain Scott had found them on his western journey, and none of us felt much inclined to seek shelter among them. Aboard the ship that night, we decided to go back and set up our base, as we had originally planned, on the barrier itself. For all available reports indicated that the clearway south was across the level barrier surface, until one could ascend one of the confluent glaciers to the high plateau which appears to form the whole interior of the continent. Captain Pardo argued strongly against this plan, asking what would become of us if the barrier calved, if our particular acre of ice broke away and started to drift northward. "Well," said Zoe, "then you won't have to come so far to meet us." But he was so persuasive on this theme that he persuaded himself into leaving one of the Yelcho's boats with us when we camped as a means of escape. We found it useful for fishing later on. My first steps on Antarctic soil, my only visit to Ross Island, had not been pleasure unalloyed. I thought of the words of the English poet, "Though every prospect pleases, and only man is vile." But then, the backside of heroism is often rather sad. Women and servants know that. They know also that the heroism may be no less real for that. But achievement is smaller than men think. What is large is the sky, the earth, the sea. The soul, I looked back as the ship sailed east again that evening. We were well into September now, with 10 hours or more of daylight. The spring sunset lingered on the 12,000-foot peak of Erebus and shone rosy gold on her long plume of steam. The steam from our own small funnel faded blue on the twilight water as we crept along under the towering pale wall of ice. On our return to Orca Bay, Sir Ernest, we learned years later, had named it the Bay of Whales. We found a sheltered nook where the barrier edge was low enough to provide fairly easy access from the ship. The Yelcho put out her ice anchor, and the next long, hard days were spent in unloading our supplies and setting up our camp on the ice, a half kilometer in from the edge, a task in which the Yelcho's crew lent us invaluable aid and interminable advice. We took all the aid gratefully, and most of the advice with salt. The weather so far had been extraordinarily mild for spring in this latitude. The temperature had not yet gone below minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and there was only one blizzard while we were setting up camp. But Captain Scott had spoken feelingly of the bitter south winds on the barrier, and we had planned accordingly. Exposed as our camp was to every wind, we built no rigid structures above ground. We set up tents to shelter in while we dug out a series of cubicles in the ice itself, lined them with hay insulation and pine boarding, and roofed them with canvas over bamboo poles, covered with snow for weight and insulation. The big central room was instantly named Buenos Aires by our Argentinians, to whom the center, wherever one is always Buenos Aires. The heating and cooking stove was in Buenos Aires. The storage tunnels and the privy, called Punta Arenas, got some back heat from the stove. The sleeping cubicles opened off Buenos Aires and were very small, mere tubes into which one crawled feet first. They were lined deeply with hay and soon warmed by one's body warmth. The sailors called them coffins and wormholes and looked with horror on our burrows in the ice. But our little warren or prairie dog village served us well, permitting us as much warmth and privacy as one could reasonably expect under the circumstances. If the Yelcho was unable to get through the ice in February, and we had to spend the winter in Antarctica, we certainly could do so, though on very limited rations. For this coming summer, our base, Sudamerica, Del Sur, South America, but we generally called it the base, was intended merely as a place to sleep, to store our provisions, and to give shelter from blizzards. To Berta and Eva, however, it was more than that. They were its chief architect designers, its most ingenious builder excavators, and its most diligent and contented occupants, forever inventing an improvement in ventilation or learning how to make skylights or revealing to us a new addition to our suite of rooms dug in the living ice. It was thanks to them that our stores were stowed so handily, that our stove drew and heated so efficiently, and that Buenos Aires, where 9 people cooked, ate, worked, conversed, argued, grumbled, painted, played the guitar and banjo, and kept the expedition's library of books and maps, was a marvel of comfort and convenience. We lived there in real amity. And if you simply had to be alone for a while, you crawled into your sleeping hole head first. Berta went a little farther. When she had done all she could to make South America livable, she dug out one more cell just under the ice surface, leaving a nearly transparent sheet of ice like a greenhouse roof, and there alone she worked at sculptures. They were beautiful forms, some like a blending of the reclining human figure with the subtle curves and volumes of the Weddell seal, others like the fantastic shapes of ice cornices and ice caves. Perhaps they are there still, under the snow and the bubble in the Great Barrier. There, where she made them, they might last as long as stone. But she could not bring them north. That is the penalty for carving in water. Captain Pardo was reluctant to leave us, but his orders did not permit him to hang about the Ross Sea indefinitely. And so at last, with many earnest injunctions to us to stay put, make no journeys, take no risks, beware of frostbite, don't use edge tools, look out for cracks in the ice, and a heartfelt promise to return to Orca Bay on the 20th of February, or as near that date as wind and ice would permit, the good man bade us farewell and his crew shouted us a great goodbye cheer as they weighed anchor. That evening, in the long orange twilight of October, we saw the topmast of the Yelcho go down the north horizon, over the edge of the world, leaving us to ice and silence and the pole. That night, we began to plan the southern journey. The ensuing month passed in short practice trips and depot laying. The life we had led at home, though in its own way strenuous, had not fitted any of us for the kind of strain met in sledge hauling at 10 or 20 degrees below freezing. We all needed as much working out as possible before we dared undertake a long haul. My longest exploratory trip, made with Dolores and Carlota, was southwest towards Mount Markham, and it was a nightmare, blizzards and pressure ice all the way out. Crevasses and no view of the mountains when we got there, and white weather and sastrugi all the way back. The trip was useful, however, in that we could begin to estimate our capacities, and also in that we had started out with a very heavy load of provisions, which we depoted at 100 and 130 miles south-southwest of base. Thereafter, other parties pushed on farther, till we had a line of snow cairns and depots right down to latitude 83 degrees 43 minutes, where Juana and Zoe, on an exploring trip, had found a kind of stone gateway opening on a great glacier leading south. We established these depots to avoid, if possible, the hunger that had bedeviled Captain Scott's southern party, and the consequent misery and weakness. And we also established to our own satisfaction, intense satisfaction, that we were sledge haulers at least as good as Captain Scott's husky dogs. Of course, we could not have expected to pull as much or as fast as his men. That we did so was because we were favored by much better weather than Captain Scott's party ever met on the barrier. And also the quantity and quality of our food made a very considerable difference. I am sure that the 15% of dried fruits in our pemmican helped prevent scurvy, and the potatoes frozen and dried according to an ancient Andean Indian method were very nourishing, yet very light and compact, perfect sledging rations. In any case, it was with considerable confidence in our capacities that we made ready at last for the southern journey. The southern party consisted of two sledge teams, Juana Dolores and myself, Carlota, Pepita, and Zoe. The support team of Berta, Eva, and Teresa set out before us with a heavy load of supplies going right up onto the glacier to prospect routes and leave depots of supplies for our return journey. We followed 5 days behind them and met them returning between Depot Ercilla and Depot Miranda, see map. That night, of course, there was no real darkness. We were all nine together in the heart of the level plain of ice. It was the 15th of November, Dolores's birthday. We celebrated by putting 8 ounces of pisco in the hot chocolate and became very merry. We sang. It is strange now to remember how thin our voices sounded in that great silence. It was overcast, white weather, without shadows and without visible horizon or any feature to break the level. There was nothing to see at all. We had come to that white place on the map, that void, and there we flew and sang like sparrows. After sleep and a good breakfast, the base party continued north, and the southern party sledged on. The sky cleared presently. High up, thin clouds passed over very rapidly from southwest to northeast. But down on the barrier it was calm and just cold enough, 5 or 10 degrees below freezing, to give a firm surface for hauling. On the level ice we never pulled less than 11 miles, 17 kilometers a day, and generally 15 or 16 miles, 25 kilometers. Our instruments, being British-made, were calibrated in feet, miles, degrees Fahrenheit, etc. But we often converted miles to kilometers because the larger number sounded more encouraging. At the time we left South America, we knew only that Mr. Shackleton had mounted another expedition to the Antarctic in 1908, had tried to attain the pole but failed, and had returned to England in June of the current year, 1909. No coherent report of his explorations had yet reached South America when we left. We did not know what route he had gone or how far he had got. But we were not altogether taken by surprise when, far across the featureless white plain, tiny beneath the mountain peaks and the strange, silent flight of the rainbow-fringed cloud wisps, we saw a fluttering dot of black. We turned west from our course to visit it. A snow heap nearly buried by the winter's storms, a flag on a bamboo pole, a mere shred of threadbare cloth, an empty oil can, and a few footprints standing some inches above the ice. In some conditions of weather, the snow compressed under one's weight remains when the surrounding soft snow melts or is scoured away by the wind. And so these reversed footprints had been left standing all these months, like rows of cobbler's lasts, a queer sight. We met no other such traces on our way. In general, I believe our course was somewhat east of Mr. Shackleton's. Juana, our surveyor, had trained herself well and was faithful and methodical in her sightings and readings, but our equipment was minimal. A theodolite on tripod legs, a sextant with artificial horizon, 2 compasses, and chronometers. We had only the wheel meter on the sledge to give distance actually traveled. In any case, it was the day after passing Mr. Shackleton's waymark that I first saw clearly the great glacier among the mountains to the southwest, which was to give us a pathway from the sea level of the barrier up to the Altiplano, 10,000 feet above. The approach was magnificent, a gateway formed by immense vertical domes and pillars of rock. Zoe and Juana had called the vast ice river that flowed through that gateway the Florence Nightingale Glacier, wishing to honor the British, who had been the inspiration and guide of our expedition. That very brave and very peculiar lady seemed to represent so much that is best and strangest in the island race. On maps, of course, this glacier bears the name Mr. Shackleton gave it, the Beardmore. The ascent of the Nightingale was not easy. The way was open at first and well marked by our support party. But after some days, we came among terrible crevasses, a maze of hidden cracks, from 1 foot to 30 feet wide and from 30 to 1,000 feet deep. Step by step we went, and step by step, and the way always upward now. We were 15 days on the glacier. At first, the weather was hot, up to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and the hot nights without darkness were wretchedly uncomfortable in our small tents. And all of us suffered more or less from snow blindness, just at the time when we wanted clear eyesight to pick our way among the ridges and crevasses of the tortured ice, and to see the wonders about and before us. For at every day's advance, more great, nameless peaks came into view in the west and southwest. Summit beyond summit, range beyond range, stark rock and snow in the unending noon. We gave names to these peaks, not very seriously, since we did not expect our discoveries to come to the attention of geographers. Zoe had a gift for naming, and it is thanks to her that certain sketch maps in various suburban South American attics bear such curious features as Bolivar's Big Nose, I Am General Rosas, the Cloudmaker, Whose Toe, and Throne of Our Lady of the Southern Cross. And when at last we got up onto the Altiplano, the great interior plateau, it was Zoe who called it the Pampa, and maintained that we walked there among vast herds of invisible cattle, transparent cattle pastured on the spindrift snow, their gauchos, the restless, merciless winds. We were by then all a little crazy with exhaustion and the great altitude, 12,000 feet, and the cold and the wind blowing and the luminous circles and crosses surrounding the suns, for often there were 3 or 4 suns in the sky up there. That is not a place where people have any business to be. We should have turned back. But since we had worked so hard to get there, it seemed that we should go on at least for a while. A blizzard came with very low temperatures, so we had to stay in the tents, in our sleeping bags, for 30 hours. A rest we all needed. Though it was warmth we needed most, and there was no warmth on that terrible plain anywhere at all but in our veins. We huddled close together all the time. The ice we lay on is 2 miles thick. It cleared suddenly and became for the plateau good weather. 12 below zero, and the wind not very strong. We three crawled out of our tent and met the others crawling out of theirs. Carlotta told us, then, that her group wished to turn back. Pepita had been feeling very ill. Even after the rest during the blizzard, her temperature would not rise above 94 degrees. Carlotta was having trouble breathing. Zoe was perfectly fit, but much preferred staying with her friends and lending them a hand in difficulties to pushing on towards the pole. So we put the 4 ounces of pisco, which we had been keeping for Christmas, into the breakfast cocoa, and dug out our tents, and loaded our sledges, and parted there, in the white daylight on the bitter plain. Our sledge was fairly light by now. We pulled on to the south. Juana calculated our position daily. On the 22nd of December, 1909, we reached the South Pole. The weather was, as always, very cruel. Nothing of any kind marked the dreary whiteness. We discussed leaving some kind of mark or monument, a snow cairn, a tent pole, and flag. But there seemed no particular reason to do so. Anything we could do, anything we were, was insignificant in that awful place. We put up the tent for shelter for an hour and made a cup of tea, and then struck 90-degree camp. Dolores, standing patient as ever in her sledging harness, looked at the snow. It was so hard frozen that it showed no trace of our footprints coming, and she said, "Which way?" "North," said Juana. It was a joke, because at that particular place There is no other direction, but we did not laugh. Our lips were cracked with frostbite and hurt too much to let us laugh. So we started back, and the wind at our backs pushed us along and dulled the knife edges of the waves of frozen snow. All that week, the blizzard wind pursued us like a pack of mad dogs. I cannot describe it. I wished we had not gone to the pole. I think I wish it even now, but I was glad even then that we had left no sign there, for some man longing to be first might come someday and find it, and know then what a fool he had been and break his heart. We talked, when we could talk, of catching up to Carlotta's party, since they might be going slower than we. In fact, they had used their tent as a sail to catch the following wind, and had got far ahead of us. But in many places they had built snow cairns or left some sign for us. Once Zoe had written on the lee side of a 10-foot sastrugi, just as children write on the sand of the beach at Miraflores, "This way out." The wind blowing over the frozen ridge had left the words perfectly distinct. In the very hour that we began to descend the glacier, the weather turned warmer, and the mad dogs were left to howl forever tethered to the pole. The distance that had taken us 15 days going up, we covered in only 8 days going down. But the good weather that had aided us descending the Nightingale became a curse down on the barrier ice, where we had looked forward to a kind of royal progress from depot to depot, eating our fill and taking our time for the last 300-odd miles. In a tight place on the glacier, I lost my goggles. I was swinging from my harness at the time in a crevasse, and then Juana had broken hers when we had to do some rock climbing coming down to the gateway. After 2 days in bright sunlight with only one pair of snow goggles to pass amongst us, we were all suffering badly from snow blindness. It became acutely painful to keep lookout for landmarks or depot flags, to take sightings, even to study the compass, which had to be laid down on the snow to steady the needle. At Concolorcorvo Depot, where there was a particularly good supply of food and fuel, we gave up, crawled into our sleeping bags with bandaged eyes, and slowly boiled alive like lobsters in the tent exposed to the relentless sun. The voices of Berta and Zoe were the sweetest sound I ever heard. A little concerned about us, they had skied south to meet us. They led us home to base. We recovered quite swiftly, but the Altiplano left its mark. When she was very little, Rosita asked if a dog had bitted Mama's toes. I told her, yes, a great white mad dog named Blizzard. My Rosita and my Juanito heard many stories when they were little about that fearful dog and how it howled on the transparent cattle of the invisible gauchos, and a river of ice 8,000 feet high called Nightingale, and how Cousin Juana drank a cup of tea standing on the bottom of the world under 7 suns, and other fairy tales. We were in for one severe shock when we reached base at last. Teresa was pregnant. I must admit that my first response to the poor girl's big belly and sheepish look was anger, rage, fury. That one of us should have concealed anything and such a thing from the others. But Teresa had done nothing of the sort. Only those who had concealed from her what she most needed to know were to blame. Brought up by servants with 4 years' schooling in a convent, and married at 16, the poor girl was still so ignorant at 20 years of age that she had thought it was the cold weather that made her miss her periods. Even this was not entirely stupid, for all of us on the southern journey had seen our periods change or stop altogether, as we experienced increasing cold, hunger, and fatigue. Teresa's appetite had begun to draw general attention, and then she had begun, as she said pathetically, to get fat. The others were worried at the thought of all the sledge hauling she had done. But she flourished, and the only problem was her positively insatiable appetite. as well as could be determined from her shy references to her last night on the hacienda with her husband. The baby was due at just about the same time as the Yelt Show, the 20th of February. But we had not been back from the southern journey 2 weeks, when on February 14th she went into labor. Several of us had borne children, and had helped with deliveries, and anyhow most of what needs to be done is fairly self-evident. But a first labor can be long and trying, and we were all anxious, while Teresa was frightened out of her wits. She kept calling for her Jose, till she was as hoarse as a skua. Zoe lost all patience at last and said, "By God, Teresa, if you say Jose once more, I hope you have a penguin." But what she had after 20 long hours was a pretty little red-faced girl. Many were the suggestions for that child's name from her 8 proud midwife aunts. Polita, Pengina, McMurdo, Victoria. But Teresa announced, after she had a good sleep and a large serving of pemmican, "I shall name her Rosa, Rosa del Sur, Rose of the South." That night we drank the last 2 bottles of Veuve Clicquot, having finished the Pisco at 88 degrees 30 minutes south, in toasts to our little Rose. On the 19th of February, a day early, my Juana came down into Buenos Aires in a hurry. "The ship," she said, "the ship has come." And she burst into tears. She, who had never wept in all our weeks of pain and weariness on the long haul. Of the return voyage, there is nothing to tell. We came back safe. In 1912, all the world learned that the brave Norwegian Amundsen had reached the South Pole, and then much later came the accounts of how Captain Scott and his men had come there after him but did not come home again. Just this year, Juana and I wrote to the captain of the Yelt Show, for the newspapers have been full of the story of his gallant dash to rescue Sir Ernest Shackleton's men from Elephant Island, and we wish to congratulate him and once more to thank him. Never one word has he breathed of our secret. He is a man of honor, Luis Pardo. I add this last note in 1929. Over the years, we have lost touch with one another. It is very difficult for women to meet when they live so far apart as we do. Since Juana died, I have seen none of my old sledge mates, though sometimes we write. Our little Rosa del Sur died of the scarlet fever when she was 5 years old. Teresa had many other children. Carlota took the veil in Santiago 10 years ago. We are old women now, with old husbands and grown children and grandchildren who might someday like to read about the expedition. Even if they are rather ashamed of having such a crazy grandmother, they may enjoy sharing in the secret. But they must not let Mr. Amundsen know. He would be terribly embarrassed and disappointed. There is no need for him or anyone else outside the family to know. We left no footprints, even.